Apo's shock troopers raced off in pursuit of the commandos. Not one of Salvo's officers had fired a weapon, but now all of them were regarding Vader with a vigilant uncertainty, their rifles half raised.
"Don't let my weapon fool you,"
Vader told them, as if reading their thoughts.
"I am not a Jedi."
From off the shrine's left, a familiar voice shouted, "But I am!" Bol Shatak had unwound her headcloth, revealing her vestigial horns, and had ignited the lightsaber Shrine thought she'd sense enough to ditch when they were captured. Vader whirled, watching Shatak as she began to stalk him, prisoners and troopers alike giving her wide berth.
"So much the better that one of you survived,"
he said, waving his lightsaber back and forth in front of him.
"The commandos saved your life, and now you hope to save theirs. Is that it?"
Shatak held her blue blade at shoulder height. "My only intent is to take you out of the hunt." Vader angled his blade to point toward the ground.
"You won't be the first Jedi I've killed."
Fearing that the prisoners would use the distraction to scatter, Salvo's men hurried in to form a cordon around them. Pressed in among everyone, Shrine lost sight of Shatak and Vader, but he could tell from the angry clashes of their blades that the duel was fast and furious. Momentarily immobilized, he allowed himself to be swept up in the surge of the crowd, so that he might be raised up over the heads of those in front of him. For a moment he was. Just long enough to glimpse Shatak, all grace and speed, working her way into her opponent's space. Her moves were broad and circular, and the lightsaber seemed an extension of her. Vader, by contrast, was clumsy, and his strikes were mostly vertical. He was, however, a full head taller than Shatak, and incredibly powerful. At various times, his stances and techniques mimicked those of Ataro and Sorisu, but Vader appeared to lack a style of his own, and executed his moves stiffly. With a whirling motion, Shatak got far enough inside Vader's long reach to inflict a forearm wound, but Vader scarcely reacted to the hit. And instead of seeing cauterized flesh, Shrine saw sparks and smoke fountain through Vader's slashed glove. Then he lost sight of them again. Wedged into the crowd, he wondered if he could use the Force to call one of the trooper's blaster rifles into his grip. He looked to the Force for guidance, and the Force restrained him. A pained cry cut through the chaos, and the crowd of prisoners parted just long enough for Shrine to see Shatak down on her knees in front of Vader, her sword arm amputated at the elbow. Vader had simply beaten her into submission, and now, with a flick of his bloodshine blade, he decapitated her. Sorrow lanced Shrine's heart. Unreadable behind his mask, Vader gazed down at Shatak's slack body. The clone troopers relaxed the cordon somewhat, allowing the prisoners to spread out. And the moment they did, Vader began to scan faces in the crowd. There were techniques for concealing one's Force abilities, and Shrine employed them. He also prepared for the possibility that he could be found out. But Vader's black gaze moved right past him. Instead, it appeared to focus on Oli's Starstone. Vader took a step in her direction. "Now I have no choice," Shrine thought. He was ready to lunge when a shock trooper called to Vader, reporting that the commandos had been captured. Vader stopped in his tracks, glancing in Starstone's direction before turning to Salvo.
"Commander, see to it that the prisoners are loaded into the transport."
Again, Vader scanned the crowd.
"A less accommodating dungeon awaits them on Aegon IX.
Vader had no sooner turned his back to the prisoners than Shrine was in motion, edging, elbowing, shouldering his way through the crowd to Starstone, whose narrow shoulders heaved as she attempted to suppress her grief at her master's death. Realizing Shrine was at her side, she turned into his comforting but brief embrace. "Your master is with the Force," he told her. "Rejoice for that." She narrowed her eyes at him. "Why didn't you help her?" "I thought we'd agreed to abandon our lightsabers." She nodded. "I abandoned mine. But you could have done something." "You're right. Maybe I should have challenged Lord Vader to a fistfight. Shrine's nostrils flared. Your master reacted in anger and in vengeance. She would have been more used to us alive. Starstone reacted as if she had been slapped. That's a heartless remark. Don't confuse emotion with truth. The prisoners were on the move now, troopers herding them toward the boarding ramp of the military transport. Fall back, Shrine said into Starstone's ear. The two of them slowed down, allowing other captives to maneuver around them. Who is Vader? Starstone asked after a moment. Shrine shook his head in ignorance. That's something we might be able to learn if we can remain alive. Starstone took her lower lip between her teeth. I'm sorry about what I said, Master. Don't worry about that. Tell me how Bolshatak was able to keep the lightsaber hidden from the guards. Force persuasion, Starstone said quietly. Did you use force persuasion at any time? She nodded. That's how I was able to hold on to my master's beacon transceiver. Shrine eyed her in surprise. You have it with you? Master Shatak told me to keep it. They were closing on the lip of the boarding ramp now, almost at the end of the line. Accepting of the inevitable, most of the prisoners were demonstrating remarkable discipline, and many of the troopers were drifting away as a result. Two troopers were stationed at the top of the ramp, one to either side of the rectangular hatch, and three more were moving more or less alongside the two Jedi. Vader is a Sith, Starstone said. Shrine showed her a long-suffering look. What do you know of the Sith? Before Master Shatak chose me as her Padawan, I trained under Master Jocasta Nu in the Temple Archives. For my review, I elected to be tested in Sith history. Congratulations. Then I don't need to remind you that a Crimson Blade doesn't guarantee that the wielder is a Sith, any more than every person strong in the Force is a Jedi. Yes, but Jedi normally don't wield Crimson Blades, Starstone argued, if only because of their association with the Sith. So even if Vader was nothing more than another apprentice of Count Dooku, why is he now serving Palpatine, Emperor Palpatine, as an executioner? You're assuming too much, Shrine said. Even if you're right, why is that so hard to believe when Dooku did just the opposite? Went from serving the Jedi Order to serving the Sith? Starstone shook her head. I suppose it shouldn't be hard to believe, Master, but it is. He looked at her. Here is what matters. Vader suspects that two Jedi are going to be aboard the prison transport. Eventually, he'll identify us and we'll be killed, unless we take our chances here and now. How, Master? Drop back with me to the end of the line. I'm going to try something, and I hope the Force is with me. If I fail, we board as instructed. Understood? Understood. The last of the captive mercenaries in Korovar moved past the two reluctant Jedi, up the ship's ramp, and through the hatch. At the top, Shrine made a passing motion with his hand to one of the troopers. There's no reason to detain us, he said. The trooper gazed at him from inside the helmet. There's no reason to detain them, he told his comrades. We're free to return to our homes. They're free to return to their homes. Everything's fine. It's time for you to board the ship. Everything's fine. It's time for us to board the ship. Shrine and Starstone waited until the final trooper had filed inside. Then they leapt from the ramp onto the clay field and concealed themselves behind one of the landing gear pods. When an opportunity presented itself, they hurried from beneath the ship and escaped into the thick vegetation, heading for what remained of Mirkana City. In his personal quarters above the Exactor, Vader examined the damage the Zabrak Jedi's lightsaber had done to his left forearm. After assuring himself that the pressure suit had self-sealed above the burn, he had peeled off the long glove and used a fine point laser cutter to remove flaps of armor weave fabric that had been fused to the alloy beneath. The Jedi's lightsaber had sliced through the shielding that bulked the glove and had melted some of the artificial ligaments that allowed the hand to pronate. Permanent repairs would have to wait until he returned to Coruscant. In the meantime, he would have to entrust his arm to the care of one of the Star Destroyer's medroids. His own lightsaber rested within reach, but the longer he gazed at it, and the blackened furrow in the alloy, the more disheartened he became. Had the hand been flesh and blood, it would be shaking now. Only Dooku, a Sage Ventress, and Obi-Wan had been good enough with a blade to injure him. So how had an undistinguished Jedi Knight been able to do so?
With the loss of my limbs, have I also lost strength in the Force?
Vader recognized the voice of the one who posed the question as the specter of Anakin. Anakin telling him that he was not as powerful as he thought he was. The little slave boy, cowering because he was not the master of his fate. A mere accessory in the world, owned by another, passed over, and now newly enslaved. He lifted his masked face to the cabin ceiling and growled in torment. Sidious's inept med droids had done this to him, slowed his reflexes, burdened him with armor and padding. He relished having destroyed them.
Or had Sidious deliberately engineered this prison? Again, it was Anakin who asked, that small note of fear in Vader's heart. Was this punishment for having failed at Mustafar? Or had Mustafar merely provided Sidious with an excuse to weaken him? Perhaps all along, the promise of apprenticeship had been nothing more than a ploy, when in fact Sidious merely needed someone to command his army of stormtroopers. Another Grievous, while Sidious reaped the real rewards of power, confident that his newest minion posed no threat to his rule. Vader dwelled on it, fearing he would drive himself mad, and at last reached an even more disheartening conclusion. Grievous was duped into serving the Sith. But Sidious had sent Anakin to Mustafar for one reason only, to kill the members of the Separatist Council. Padme and Obi-Wan were the ones who had sentenced him to his black suit prison. Sentenced by his wife and his alleged best friend, their love for him warped by what they'd perceived as betrayal. Obi-Wan, too brainwashed by the Jedi to recognize the power of the dark side. And Padme, too enslaved to the Republic to understand that Palpatine's machinations and Anakin's defection to the Sith had been essential to bringing peace to the galaxy. Essential in placing power in the hands of those resourceful enough to use it properly in order to save the galaxy's myriad species from themselves, to end the incompetence of the Senate, to dissolve the bloated, entitled Jedi Order, whose masters were blind to the decay they had fostered. And yet their chosen one had seen it. So why hadn't they followed his lead by embracing the dark side? Because they were too set in their ways, too inflexible to adapt. Vader mused. Anakin Skywalker had died on Coruscant, but the chosen one had died on Mustafar. Blistering rage, as seething as Mustafar's lava flows, welled up in him, liquefying self-pity. This was what he saw behind the mask's visual enhancers. Bubbling lava, red heat, scorched flesh. He had only wanted to save them. Padme from death, Obi-Wan from ignorance. And in the end, they had failed to recognize his power, to simply accede to him, to accept on faith that he knew what was best for them, for everyone. Instead, Padme was dead and Obi-Wan was running for his life, as stripped of everything as Vader was, without friends, family, purpose. Clenching his right hand, he cursed the Force. What had it ever provided him but pain, torturing him with foresight, with visions he was unable to prevent, leading him to believe that he had great power when he was little more than its servant. But no longer, Vader promised himself. The power of the dark side would render the Force subservient, minion rather than ally. Extending his right arm, he took hold of the lightsaber and turned it about in his hand. Just 3 standard weeks old, assembled as Sidious had wished, in the shadow of the moonlit-sized terror weapon he was having constructed. It had now tasted first blood. The Sith grew past the use of lightsabers, Sidious had told him,
but we continue to use them, if only to humiliate the Jedi. Vader yearned for the time when memories of Anakin would fade like light absorbed by a black hole. Until that happened, his life-sustaining suit would be an ill fit, even if it was well-suited to the darkness in his invulnerable heart. The comlink chimed.
What is it, Commander Apo?
Lord Vader, I've been informed of a discrepancy in the prisoner count. Allowing for the Jedi you killed on Mercana, two prisoners are unaccounted for.
The others who survived Order 66.
Shall I instruct Commander Salva to initiate a search?
Not this time, Commander. I will handle it myself.
Down there, Starstone said. Halting at the head of a creepy stairway, Shrine was already descending. The stairs led to the basement of a rambling building that had been left unscathed by the battle, and was typical of those that crowned the Verdant Hills south of Mercana City. But she had a bad feeling about the stairway.
Don't worry. This is only Cash's way of keeping out the riffraff.
How is it you know this person? She asked over his shoulder.
Garyalan's the reason the Council first sent me to Mercana. He's a former Black Sun Vigo. I came here to put him out of business, but he turned out to be one of our best sources of intelligence on Separatist activities in this quadrant.
Years before Geonosis, Garyalan was warning us about the extent of Dooku's military buildup, but no one on the Council, or in the Senate, seemed to take the threat seriously. And in return for your intelligence, you allowed Garyalan to remain in business. He's not a hut. He deals in, wholesale commodities. So not only are we on the run, we're turning to gangsters for help. Maybe you have a better idea? No, Master, I don't. I didn't think so. And stop calling me Master. Someone will either make the Jedi connection or get the impression you're my servant. Force forbid, Starstone muttered. I'm Roan, plain and simple. At the foot of the stairs was an unadorned door. Shrine rapped his knuckles on the jamb, and to the droid eyeball that poked through a circular portal, in response said something in what Starstone surmised was Korovar. A moment later, the door slid into its housing to reveal a muscular and extensively tattooed human male, cradling a DC-17 blaster rifle. Smiling at Shrine, he ushered them into a surprisingly opulent foyer.
Still sneaking up on people, huh, Shrine?
Old habits. Shrine peered into the back room. Is he here, Jolly?
He's here, but not for long. Just packing up what we couldn't move before the invasion. I'll tell him.
Let's make it a surprise. Jolly laughed shortly.
Ooh, he'll be surprised, all right.
Shrine motioned for Starstone to follow him. On the far side of a beaded curtain entryway, a mixed group of humans, aliens, and labor droids were hauling packing crates into a spacious turbolift. Even more well-appointed than the foyer, the room was cluttered with furniture, info storage and communications devices, weapons, and more. The humanoid standing in the midst of it and dispensing orders to his underlings was a Twi'lek, with fatty leku and a prominent paunch. Sensing someone behind him, he turned and stared open-mouthed at Shrine.
I heard you'd been killed.
Wishful thinking, Shrine said. Cash Garyalan moved his head from side to side.
Perhaps.
He extended his fat arms and shook both of Shrine's hands, then gestured to Shrine's filthy robe.
I love the new look.
I got tired of wearing brown. His gaze shifted.
Who's your new friend, Roan?
Oli, Shrine said without elaboration. He aimed a glance at the packing crates.
Clearance sale, Cash? Let's just say that peace has been bad for business.
Then it is over, Shrine asked solemnly. Garyalan inclined his large head.
You hadn't heard? It was all over the Holonet, Roan.
Oli and I have been out of touch. Garyalan snapped his fat fingers.
Just like that. One moment, Chancellor Palpatine has been kidnapped by General Grievous. The next, Dooku and Grievous are dead, the Jedi are traitors, the battle droid shut down, and we're one big happy galaxy again, more united than before. An empire, no less. No formal surrender by the Confederacy of Independent Systems, no bogged-down Senate, no trade embargoes, and whatever the Emperor wants, the Emperor gets. Any comments from the members of the Separatist Council? Shrine asked. Not a peep. I have to say, I never would have guessed the Jedi would be held accountable.
For attempting to arrest Palpatine, you mean? Shrine said.
No, for the war.
Garulin stared at Shrine for a long moment.
I hate to be the bearer of bad news, Rhone, especially to you, of all people. But the war has been laid at the feet of the Jedi. You manipulated the whole charade. Vat-grown troopers on one side, Master Dooku on the other, all in an attempt to overthrow the Republic and place yourselves in charge. That's why Palpatine ordered your execution, and why the Jedi Temple was sacked.
Shrine and Starstone traded looks of dread. Reading their expressions, the crime boss adopted a somber tone.
From what I understand, nearly all of the Jedi were killed, in the temple or on one world or another.
Shrine put his arm around Starstone's quaking shoulders.
Steady, kid, he said, as much to himself as to Oli.
The order was finished. Not only was there nothing for Shrine and Starstone on Coruscant, there was nothing for them anywhere.
For what it's worth, Garulin said, I don't believe a word of it. Palpatine is behind this. He has been from the start.
Starstone was shaking her head back and forth in disbelief. It's not possible that every Jedi has been killed. She turned to Shrine.
Some Jedi weren't even with clone troopers, Master. Other commanders may have refused to obey High Command's execution orders.
You're right, Shrine said, trying to sound comforting.
We'll find other survivors.
Sure we will.
The Order will rebuild itself.
Absolutely.
Garulin waited for them to fall silent before saying,
A lot of others have had the carpet yanked out from under them. Even those of us at the bottom of the food chain.
He laughed regretfully.
War has always been better for us than peace. At least the corporate alliance was willing to tolerate us for a share of the profits. But the regional governors the Emperor installed are out to cast us as the new enemy. And between you and me, I'd sooner deal with the Hutts.
Shrine studied him.
Where's that leave you, Cash? Not on Mercana, that much is certain. My Korovar competitors in crime have my blessings and my sympathy.
Garulin returned Shrine's look.
What about you, Rhone? Any ideas?
Not right now, Shrine said.
Perhaps you should consider working for me. I could use people with your special talents, especially now. I owe you a favor in any case.
Starstone glared at him.
We haven't fallen so low as to...
She started to say when Shrine clamped his hand over her mouth.
Maybe I will consider it.
But first, you've got to get us off Mercana.
Garulin showed Shrine the palms of his hands. I don't owe you that much.
Make it happen, and I'll owe you. Starstone looked from Shrine to Garulin and back again.
Is this the way you were before the war? Cutting deals with anyone you pleased?
Don't mind her, Shrine said.
What about it, Cash? Garulin sat back in his oversized chair.
Shouldn't be too hard to equip you with false identities and outwit the local garrison troopers.
Normally, I'd agree, Shrine cut in. But someone new has been added to the mix. A Lord Vader. When Garulin didn't react to the name, he continued.
A sort of black-armored version of Grievous, only more dangerous, and apparently in charge of doing Palpatine's dirty work.
Really?
Garulin said, clearly interested.
I haven't heard anything about him.
You will, Shrine said. And he could present a problem to our getting off this rock.
Garulin stroked his leku.
Well then, I may have to rethink my offer, in the interest of avoiding Imperial complications. Or, we may simply need to take additional precautions.
Cash Garulin was trying to figure out how he could unload 800 pairs of knockoff NeuroSav electrobinoculars in a hurry, when Jali burst into his office to draw his attention to the security monitors. In mounting annoyance, Garulin watched 20 clone troopers climb from a wheeled transport and take up positions around the aged sprawling structure that was his headquarters.
"Stormtroopers, no less," Garulin said.
Pushing himself upright, he swept a stack of data cards from his desk into an open attaché case.
"I'll take the back stairs and meet you at the docking bay."
Hurrying out of his office and through the stockroom, he pressed the release for the back door, only to find a towering figure filling the entryway. Dressed in black from outsized helmet to knee-high boots, the masked figure had his gloved fists planted on his hips in a way that spread his cloak wide.
"Going somewhere, Vigo."
"Vader," Garulin told himself. The grievous-like monstrosity Shrine said had been added to the mix.
"May I inquire who wishes to know?"
"You're free to ask,"
Vader said, but left it at that. Stretching out his right hand, Vader yanked Garulin off his feet and carried him through the foyer and into the office, where he deposited him in a caster chair which rolled backward and struck the wall.
"Make yourself comfortable,"
Vader said. Garulin rubbed the back of his head.
"It's going to be like that, is it?"
"Yes, like that."
Vader stood over him.
"I'm searching for two Jedi who escaped the transport that was to have delivered them to Aegon IX.
"Enchanting spot. But what makes you think?"
"Before you say another word, be advised that I know that you and one of the Jedi go back a long way."
Garulin immediately revised his plans.
"You're talking about Rhone Shrine and the girl."
"Then they did come here."
Garulin nodded.
"They asked for my help in leaving Mercana."
"What arrangements did you make?"
"Arrangements?"
Garulin gestured broadly to the room.
"I didn't come by all this by accident. I was surprised even to see Shrine alive.
I told them that I don't help traitors. In fact, I reported their visit to local authorities." Vader turned to the stormtrooper commander, who nodded his head and moved into the packing room.
"You wouldn't lie to me, Vigo."
"Not until I get to know you better."
The commander returned.
"He did contact the local garrison commander, Lord Vader."
It was impossible to determine if Vader was at all satisfied. At last, Vader said,
"If you were Shrine, what would be your next move?"
"Well, now we're speculating, aren't we?"
Garulin said, relaxing somewhat.
"I mean, you appear to be asking my professional opinion on the matter."
"And if I am?"
"I only thought there might be something in it for me."
"What is it you want, Vigo?"
Garulin adopted a more serious tone.
"I need you to put in a good word for me with the regional governor."
Vader nodded.
"That can be arranged, provided that your professional opinion amounts to anything."
Garulin leaned forward.
"There's this Korovar by the name of Biato. Dabbles in smuggling and other ventures. Owns a very fast ship called the Dead Ringer."
He paused while the commander disappeared once more, undoubtedly to communicate with space traffic control.
"If I were in a hurry to get off-world with the least amount of problems, Biato's the one I'd turn to."
"Lord Vader,"
the commander said suddenly,
"STC reports that the Dead Ringer recently launched from Mercana Landing. We have the projected flight path."
Wings folded above its fuselage and running lights powering down, Vader's shuttle entered the Exactor's main docking bay and alighted on the lustrous deck. Nearby, and surrounded by clone troopers, sat the Dead Ringer, a somewhat boxy cargo transport
heavily armed with turbolaser cannons and outfitted with a state-of-the-art hyperdrive. Also under guard, the transport's mostly Korvar crew of seven stood with their hands clasped atop their horned heads while troopers completed a search of the ship. Already offloaded cargo containers were stacked outside the Dead Ringer starboard docking ring, awaiting scans. Vader and Apo descended the shuttle's boarding ramp and strode over to where the crew had been gathered. A trooper indicated the captain, and Vader approached him.
What is your cargo, Captain?
The Korvar glowered up at him.
I demand to speak to the officer in charge.
You are speaking to him.
The captain blinked in surprise, but managed to hold on to his angry tone.
I don't know who you are, but be forewarned that if my ship suffered any damage as a result of being targeted by a tractor beam, I will lodge a formal complaint with the regional governor.
Duly noted, Captain,
Vader said.
And I'm certain that the regional governor will take a keen interest in you once he learns that you are transporting prescribed weapons.
He swung to the officer in charge of the troopers.
Escort them to the brig.
Lord Vader,
Apo said, while the crew was being whisked away.
Security reports that two humans have been found in a secret compartment beneath the ship's galley.
Vader turned in the direction of the transport.
Interesting. Let's see what security has uncovered.
By the time Vader and Apo had moved around to the transport's port side, a detail of troopers was emerging from the ship with two humans in custody. The man was tall and long-haired and very protective of the young woman by his side. The pair were dressed alike in robes and headcloths typical of the mercenary brigade that had fought for the Separatists on Mirkana. Their eyes widened on seeing Vader.
They are unarmed, Lord Vader,
one of the troopers announced.
We stowed away without the captain's knowledge, the man said. We're only trying to get to Ord Mantell.
You're not stowaways,
Vader said.
The captain was well paid to take you aboard his ship, and you have been promised payment as well.
The girl began to quake in fear.
We didn't know we were doing anything illegal. We're not smugglers or criminals. I'm telling you the truth. We did it only for the credits.
Vader appraised her.
I will consider sparing your lives if you tell me who hired you to carry out this deception.
The man firmed his lips, then swallowed hard and spoke.
Some of Cash Garrelin's goons.
Vader nodded.
Just as I suspected.
Lord Vader, our sensors may have found something,
Apo said suddenly.
The craft is only a cloak shape that launched from the outskirts of Mirkana City. But it is pursuing a course that will take it close to the Exactor's previous position, and it is attempting to evade our scans.
The Jedi are aboard that craft. Can we interdict from our present position, Commander?
No. The cloak shape is out of the range of our tractor beam.
Vader growled in displeasure.
We will need to remedy that. Is my starfighter prepared?
It's waiting in Launching Bay 3.
Assign two pilots to serve as my wingmates. Tell them to rendezvous with me in the launching bay.
The cloak shape, a broad-winged craft with a transverse maneuvering fin, had been modified for spaceflight. The cockpit had been enlarged to accommodate pilot and co-pilot, and a rear-facing gunner's chair had been installed in the tail section. Shrine was forward, Starstone aft, and in the pilot's seat was Broody Gain, a freelancer who made occasional runs for Cash Garrelin. A rangy, dark-haired human a few years older than Shrine, he spoke basic with a strong Outer Rim accent. Shrine had already decided that Gain was the most casual pilot he'd ever flown with. Any farther from the instrument panel and his chair would have been adjacent to Starstone's. His hold on the yoke was negligent. Yet he handled the craft masterfully and didn't miss a trick.
Well, they've got a good fix on us,
he told Shrine and Starstone through their helmet comlinks.
Definitely going to have to upgrade our countermeasures at some point.
Hanging far to starboard, Vader's massive warship was just visible through the cloak-shaped triangle of transparasteel viewport. The console issued an alert chime, and Gain leaned forward a bit to study one of the display screens.
Three bandits closing on our tail, Signatures ID them as two V-Wings and what might be a modified Jedi Interceptor. This Vader character? Good bet. Guess the Empire isn't any more choosy about commandeering Jedi hardware than it is Sep gear.
Obviously, we're still serving Palpatine in our own way.
Are you two aware that three starfighters are chasing us?
Starstone broke in.
Thanks for the heads up, sweetheart, but we're on it, Gain said. Here's another heads up for you, Flyboy. They're gaining on us. Can't you coax any more speed out of this junker? It's about as lethargic as you are.
Gain laughed shortly.
I suppose I could try jettisoning the tail gunner. That ought to lighten us up.
First, you might try letting some of the hot air out of yourself. Starstone fired back.
Ouch, Gain said. Is she always like this, Shrine?
She was a librarian. You know how they can be.
A librarian with the Force. Very dangerous combination.
He chuckled to himself, then asked, What happens to the Force now? Without the Jedi Order, I mean.
I don't know, Shrine said. Maybe it goes into hibernation.
Gain rocked his head from side to side.
Well, here's a little something to show you that the Force isn't the only game in town.
Gazing in the direction indicated by Broody Gain's gloved right hand, Shrine saw a swift space skiff approaching the cloak shape on an intercept course.
Hope it's on our side.
Gain laughed again.
It's our ticket out of here.
All but wedged into the cockpit of his black interceptor, Vader was in full command of the situation. He had the starfighter's inertial compensator dialed down and felt revitalized by the experience of near weightlessness. The cloak shape's lead evaporated as he made adjustments and poured on speed. The Jedi's choice of escape vehicles was a reflection of their desperation, since the cloak shape lacked a hyperdrive of any sort. But Vader saw what they had in mind. They hoped to rendezvous with the Soro sub skiff that even now was angling toward them. The plan would have worked, however, only if Vader had taken the Twi'lek crime boss at his word. And because he hadn't, the Jedi wouldn't have enough time to transfer to the larger ship. By then, both the cloak shape and the skiff would be in proton torpedo range.
Form up on me,
he told the clone pilots in the escort V-Wings.
And fire on my command. There's no need to take them alive.
Lord Vader, we have identified the Soro sub.
One of the pilots returned.
The registry is Mirkana. The owner is Cash Garulin.
So,
Vader said, mostly to himself.
It all ends here.
But there's something else, Lord Vader. The cloak shape appears to be fitted with external booster ring adapters.
Glancing at the display screen in which the cloak shape was centered, Vader issued a command to the astromech droid to display the skiff on a secondary screen. Instantly, he understood.
All speed,
he ordered the clone pilots.
This is not a rendezvous. Fire proton torpedoes the moment our targets are in range.
It was going to be close, Vader realized. He enabled the interceptor's laser cannon. The cloak shape, too, was traveling flat out and was faster than he would have thought possible. The pilot was skilled and artful. At this distance, it would be difficult to keep him in laser lock. The astromech set an update to the cockpit data screen, and at the same time, the voice of one of the escort pilots issued through the console comlink.
Lord Vader, the skiff is positioning a hyperdrive booster in the cloak shape's flight path.
The vision enhancers built into Vader's mask delivered a close-up of the red and white hypermatter ring. Quickly, he thumbed the triggers on the steering yoke, and a hail of crimson bolts streaked from the interceptor's long-barreled laser cannons. But it was unlikely that the bolts would ever reach their targets, because the targets would be long gone. Still calling all power from the ion drive, Vader watched the cloak shape slip neatly into the precisely positioned booster ring and make the jump to light speed. A split second later, Cash Garulin's skiff engaged its hyperdrive and disappeared. Allowing the interceptor to power down, Vader gazed in defeat at the distant starfield. He had much to do to make himself whole once more. One of the V-Wing pilots hailed him.
Escape vectors are being plotted, Lord Vader.
Delete the calculations, pilot. If the Jedi are so determined to disappear, then let them.
Part 3. Imperial Center.
You have my full assurance that I will not disband the Senate,
the Emperor told the small audience he'd summoned to his new chambers.
Furthermore, I don't want you to think of yourselves as mere accessories, ratifying legislation and facilitating the business of governing. I will seek your counsel in enacting laws that will serve the growth and integrity of our empire.
He fell silent for a moment, then delivered his bombshell.
The difference now is that when I have taken into account your contributions and those of my advisors, my judgment will be final. There will be no debates, no citations of constitutional precedent, no power of veto, no court proceedings or deferrals. My decrees will be issued simultaneously to our constituent worlds, and they will take effect immediately.
The Emperor leaned forward in the high-backed chair that was his temporary throne, but not so far forward that his disfigured face was placed in the light.
Understand this. You no longer represent your home worlds solely. Coruscant, Alderaan, Chandrilla, all these, and tens of thousands of worlds far removed from the core, are cells of the Empire. And what affects one affects us all. No disturbances will be tolerated. Interplanetary squabbles or threats of secession will meet with harsh reprisals. I have not led us through 3 years of galactic warfare to allow a resurgence of the old ways. The Republic is extinct.
Bail Organa barely managed to keep from squirming in his chair, as some of the Emperor's other invited guests were doing. Senators Mon Mothma and Garmbel Iblis especially, in what almost amounted to overt defiance. But if the Emperor was taking notes, he was doing so without most of his guests being aware of it. The Emperor's new chambers, the throne room for all intents and purposes, occupied an upper floor of Coruscant's tallest building, and in design more closely resembled what had been Palpatine's holding office below the Senate Rotunda than his former quarters in the Senate office building.
Your Majesty, if I may,
the human senator from Kaminor said in a suitably deferential tone,
perhaps you could shed some light on the matter of why the Jedi betrayed us. As you are undoubtedly aware, the Holonet seems reluctant to provide details.
Well beyond the need to employ diplomacy or deception to achieve his ends, the Emperor made a derisive sound.
The Order deserved all that it received for deluding us into believing that they served me in serving you. The complexity of their nefarious plan continues to astound me. Why they didn't attempt to kill me 3 years ago is something I will never understand. As if I could have stood against them. If it were not for the recent actions of my guards and our troopers, I would be dead.
Palpatine's off-color eyes clouded with hatred.
In fact, the Jedi believed that they could oversee the galaxy better than we could, and they were willing to perpetuate a war simply to leave us defenseless and susceptible to their treason. Their vaunted temple was a fort, their base of operations. They came to me with tales of having killed General Grievous, a cyborg no less, and sought to arrest me because I refused to take them at their word that the fighting was suddenly over. The Separatists defeated. When I dispatched a legion of troopers to reason with them, they drew their lightsabers and the battle was met. We have the Grand Army to thank for our victory. Our noble commanders recognized the truth of the Jedi's treachery, and they executed my commands with vigor. The very fact that they did so, without question, without hesitation, suggests to me that our troopers had some inkling all along that the Jedi were manipulating events. After all these weeks, we still lack confirmation that Viceroy Gunray and his powerful allies are dead, that their battle droids and war machines stand motionless on hundreds of worlds we can take as a sign of their surrender. At the same time, however, we must focus our attention on solidifying the Empire world by world.
Palpatine sat back in his chair.
The Jedi Order is a lesson to us that we cannot permit any agency to become powerful enough to pose a threat to our designs or to the freedoms we enjoy. That is why it is essential we increase and centralize our military, both to preserve the peace and to protect the Empire against inevitable attempts at insurrection. To that end, I have already ordered the production of new classes of capital ships and starfighters, suitable for command by non-clone officers and crew, who themselves will be the product of Imperial academies, made up of candidates drawn from existing star system flight schools. No less important, our present army of clone troopers is aging at an accelerated rate, and will need to be supplemented, gradually replaced, by new batches of clones. I suspect that the Jedi had a hand in creating a short-lived army in full confidence that there would be no need for troopers once they'd overthrown the Republic and instituted their theocracy based on the Force. But that is no longer a concern. By bringing the known worlds of the galaxy under one law, one language, the enlightened guidance of one individual, corruption of the sort that plagued the former Republic will never be able to take root, and the regional governors I've installed will prevent the growth of another separatist movement.
The war continues, Mon Mothma said to Bail. Confident that they were beyond the reach of the building's assortment of eavesdropping devices, and far enough from anyone who might be an Internal Security Bureau spy, Bail said,
Palpatine will use his disfigurement to distance himself further from the Senate. We may never get that close to him again.
Mon Mothma lowered her head in sadness as they continued to walk.
When I look at that hideous face, or survey the damage done to the Rotunda, I can't help thinking, this is what's become of the Republic and the Constitution,
Mon Mothma said.
He maintains he has no plans for disbanding the Senate or punishing the various hive species that supported the Confederacy.
Bail started.
For the moment,
Mon Mothma interrupted.
Besides, the home worlds of those species have already been punished. They are disaster areas.
He can't afford to move against anyone just now,
Bail went on.
Too many worlds are still too well armed. Yes, new clone troopers are being grown and new capital ships are coming off the line, but not fast enough for him to risk becoming enmeshed in another war.
She looked at him skeptically.
You're very confident all of a sudden, Bail. Or is that circumspection I hear?
Bail asked himself the same question. In the throne room, he'd tried to puzzle out which among the Emperor's cabal of advisors, human or otherwise, were aware that Palpatine was a Sith Lord who'd manipulated the entire war and eradicated his sworn enemies, the Jedi, as part of a plan to assume absolute power over the galaxy.
Certainly Mas Amida knew, along with Sait Pestage and possibly Sly Moore.
Bail doubted that Armand Isard or any of Palpatine's military advisors knew. How would their knowing change things in any case? To the few beings who knew or cared, the Sith were nothing more than a quasi-religious sect that had disappeared a millennium ago. What mattered was that Palpatine was now Emperor Palpatine, and that he enjoyed the staunch support of most of the Senate and the unwavering allegiance of the Grand Army. Only Palpatine knew the full story of the war and its abrupt conclusion. But Bail knew a few things that Palpatine didn't. Primarily, that Anakin Skywalker and Padme Amidala's twin children had not died with her on the asteroid known as Polis Massa. And that in the twins, Jedi Masters Obi-Wan Kenobi and Yoda were placing their trust for the eventual defeat of the dark side. Even now, infant Luke was on Tatooine in the care of his aunt and uncle and being watched over by Obi-Wan. And infant Leia. Bail grinned just thinking about her. Infant Leia was an Alderaan, probably in the arms of Bail's wife, Breeha.
There's talk in the Senate about building a palace to house Palpatine, his advisors, and the Imperial Guard, she said, as they were nearing one of the repulsor lift landing platforms attached to what had become Palpatine's building.
Bail had heard the talk. "And statues," he said.
"Bail, the fact that Palpatine doesn't have full faith in his new order makes him all the more dangerous."
She came to a sudden halt when they reached the walkway to the landing platform and turned to him.
"Every signatory of the petition of the 2000 is suspect. Do you know that Fang Zar has fled Coruscant?"
"I do," Bail said, just managing to hold Mon Mothma's gaze.
"Clone army or no, Bail, I'm not going to abandon the fight. We have to act while we still can, while Cern Prime, Eniska, Kashyyyk, and other worlds are prepared to join us."
Bail worked his jaw. "It's too soon to act. We have to bide our time," he said. "We have to place our trust in the future and in the Force."
Mon Mothma adopted a skeptical look. "Right now, there are members of the military who will side with us, who know that the Jedi never betrayed the Republic. What counts is that the clone troopers believe that the Jedi did betray the Republic,"
Bail said. Then he lowered his voice to add,
"We risk everything by placing ourselves in Palpatine's sights just now."
He kept to himself his concerns for Leia. Mon Mothma didn't say another word until they stepped onto the landing platform, where stormtroopers and a tall, startling figure in black were striding down the boarding ramp of a Theta-class shuttle that had just set down.
"Some Jedi must have survived the execution order," Mon Mothma said at last.
For reasons he couldn't fully understand, Bail's attention was riveted on the masked figure, who appeared to be in command of the clones, and who also appeared to glance with clear purpose in Bail's direction. The group passed close enough to Bail for him to hear one of the stormtroopers say,
"The Emperor is waiting for you in the facility, Lord Vader."
Bail felt as if someone had let the air out of him. His legs began to shake, and he grabbed hold of the platform railing for support, somehow managing to keep apprehension from his voice when he said to Mon Mothma,
"You're right. Some Jedi did survive."
In the capable hands of gangly Broody Gain, the modified cloak shape and the booster ring that had allowed it to enter hyperspace completed 3 short jumps in as many hours, emerging in a remote area of the Teon cluster, far from any inhabited worlds. Waiting there, however, was a 20-year-old Corellian freighter as large as a Tantive-class corvette, but with a circular command module. Shrine counted 5 gun turrets. He already knew from Broody that the drunk dancer boasted sublights and a hyperdrive better suited to a ship twice its size. Broody disengaged from the booster ring while they were still some distance from the freighter. Then, in his own good time, maneuvered the cloak shape through a magnetic containment shield in the drunk dancer's starboard side and into a spacious docking bay. On their landing discs sat a small dropship and a swift, split-winged incom relay, not much bigger than the cloak shape. Broody popped the canopy, and Shrine and Starstone climbed down to the deck, slipping out of their helmets and flight suits at the bottom of the ladder. Alerted to the cloak shape's arrival, several members of the drunk dancer's crew were waiting in the docking bay. Dressed in bits and pieces of apparel they'd obviously obtained on dozens of worlds, they were a ragtag band of freelance smugglers, without star system or political affiliation, or bones to pick with anyone. Determined to maintain their autonomy, they had learned that smugglers didn't get rich by working for others. In the docking bay, Shrine and Starstone were introduced to the drunk dancer's first mate, Skek Draggle, and the freighter security chief, Archer Bile. Both were humanoids, as long-limbed as Broody Gain, with 6-fingered hands and severe facial features that belied cheerful dispositions. In the ship's main cabin space, the two Jedi met Philly Bitters, a tow-headed human slicer who took an immediate interest in Starstone, and the drunk dancer's communications expert, Isle Dix, whose hairless dark green head hoisted 2 pair of curling antennae, in addition to a pair of sharp-tipped ears. Before long, everyone, including a couple of inquisitive droids, had gathered in the main cabin to hear Shrine and Starstone's account of their narrow escape from Mirkana. "Cash asked that we bring it a Mosak," Skek Draggle said, after the Jedi had entertained everyone with details of the daring flight. "Mosak's just the other side of Felucia, and a decent hub for jumps into the Tingle Arm, or just about anywhere up and down the Perlemium trade route." He looked directly at Shrine.
We, normally don't offer free transport, but seeing how it was Cash who asked and, knowing what you folk have had to endure, we'll cover the costs.
We appreciate that, Shrine said, sensing the sharp-featured Skek had left something unstated.
The Twi'lek fix you with new identity chips?
Archer asked, in what seemed to be actual concern.
Shrine nodded. Good enough to fool agents at Mirkana SDC, anyway. Then they'll pass muster on Mosak as well, the lanky security chief said. You shouldn't have too much trouble finding temporary work, if that's your plan.
Archer regarded Shrine.
You have any contacts you can trust?
Shrine's eyebrows bobbed.
Good question.
When the assembled crew members fell into a separate conversation, Starstone moved close to Shrine.
Just what is our plan, Mast?
Shrine's lifted finger stopped her mid-sentence. No order, no ranks.
You don't know that, she said, echoing his quiet tone. You agreed that other Jedi probably survived.
Listen, kid, he said, gazing at her for emphasis. The climbers of this galaxy are few and far between.
Jedi could have survived by other means. It's our duty to locate them.
Our duty?
To ourselves. To the Force.
Shrine took a deep breath. How do you propose we do that? She gnawed at her lower lip while she considered it, then looked at him pointedly.
We have Master Shatak's beacon transceiver. If we could patch it into the Drunk Dancer's communication suite, we could issue a 913 code on encrypted frequencies.
Shrine laughed in spite of himself.
You know, that could actually work.
He glanced at the crew members.
Still, I wouldn't get my hopes up if I were you.
She returned the smile.
But you're not me.
When Shrine turned back to the crew, he found Skek gazing at him.
So I guess your scheme failed, huh?
Which scheme would that be, Chief?
Skek glanced at his crewmates before answering.
Knocking Palpatine off his perch. Fighting the war the way it probably should have been fought all along.
You've been misinformed, Shrine said flatly.
Skek sat back and feigned nonchalance.
Really? We've all heard the recordings of what went on in Palpatine's chambers.
The other crew members nodded somberly.
Don't get me wrong, the first mate continued before Shrine could respond. I've nothing against any of you personally, but you have to admit, the way some of your people conducted themselves when Republic interests were at stake, the prestige you enjoyed, the wealth you amassed.
I give the Jedi credit for trying,
the slicer Philly Bitters chimed in.
But you should never have left yourself so shorthanded on Coruscant. Not with so many troopers garrisoned there.
Shrine laughed cheerlessly. We were needed in the Outer Rim sieges, you see.
Don't you get it? Isle Dix said. The Jedi were played.
When she shrugged her narrow shoulders, her twin antennae bobbed.
That's what Cash thinks anyway.
Skek laughed in derision.
From where I sit, getting played is worse than losing.
You'll be safe from Imperial reach on Mosak, Bitter said quickly, in an obvious attempt to be cheerful.
Sudden silence told Shrine that none of the Drunk Dancer's crew was buying the slicer's optimism.
I realize that we're already in your debt, he said at last, but we've a proposition for you.
Skek's green eyes widened in interest.
Lay it out. Let's see how it looks.
Shrine turned to Starstone.
Tell them.
She gestured to herself.
Me?
It was your idea, kid.
Okay.
Starstone began uncertainly.
Sure.
She cleared her voice.
We're hoping to make contact with other Jedi who survived Palpatine's execution orders. We have a transceiver capable of transmitting on encrypted frequencies. Any Jedi who survived will be doing the same thing, or listening for special transmissions. The thing is, we need to use the Drunk Dancer's communication suite.
That's a little like whistling in the stellar wind, isn't it?
Dick said.
From what we hear, the clones got the drop on all of you.
Almost all of us,
Starstone said. Bitters was rocking his head back and forth in uncertainty, but Shrine could tell that the white-haired computer expert was excited by the idea, and perhaps grateful for a chance to win points with Oli.
Regardless, Philly said, could be dangerous. The Empire might be onto those frequencies by now.
Not if as many of us are dead as all of you seem to think, Shrine countered.
Bitters, Dix, and Archer waited for Skek to speak.
Well, of course, we'd have to get the captain to agree, he said at last. Anyway, I'm still waiting to hear the rest of the proposition, the part that makes it worth our while.
Everyone looked at Shrine. The Jedi have means of accessing emergency funds, he said, with a covert motion of his hand. You don't have to worry about being paid for your services. Skek nodded, satisfied.
Then we don't have to worry about being paid for our services.
While Starstone was staring at Shrine in appalled disbelief, and the crew members were talking among themselves about how best to slave the Jedi beacon transceiver to the communication suite, Broody Gain and a tall human woman entered the cabin space from the direction of the drunk dancer's bulbous cockpit. The woman's black hair was shot through with gray, and her age showed there and in her face more than in the way she moved.
Captain,
Skek said, coming to his feet, but she ignored him, her gray eyes fixed on Shrine.
Rhone Shrine,
she said. Shrine looked up at her.
Last time I checked.
She forced an exhale and shook her head in incredulity.
Star's End, it really is you.
She sat down opposite Shrine without once taking her eyes off him.
You're the image of Jen.
Baffled, Shrine said.
Do I know you?
She nodded and laughed. On a cellular level, at any rate. She touched herself on the chest.
I gave birth to you. I'm your mother, Jedi.
The Emperor's Medical Rehabilitation Laboratory occupied the crown of Coruscant's tallest building. A room of modest size, the laboratory's antechamber closely resembled his former chambers in the Senate office building and featured a semicircle of padded couch, three swivel chairs with shell-shaped backs, and a trio of squat holoprojectors shaped like truncated cones. Palpatine sat in the center chair, his hands on his knees, the lights of Coruscant blazing behind him through a long arc of fixed windows. The cowl of his heavy robe was lowered, and the blinking telltales of an array of devices and control panels lit his deeply creased face, the face he kept concealed from his advisors and senatorial guests. For here, he was not simply Emperor Palpatine. He was Darth Sidious, Dark Lord of the Sith. On the far side of thick panels of transparasteel that separated the antechamber from a rib-walled operating theater, Vader sat on the edge of the surgical table on which he had been recalled to life and transformed. His flaring black helmet had been lifted from his head by servos that extended from the laboratory ceiling, revealing the pasty complexion of his synth flesh face and the raised wounds on his head that might never fully heal. The medical droids, responsible for repairing what had remained of Vader's amputated limbs and incinerated body, some of which had observed and participated in the cyborg transformation of General Grievous on Geonosis a decade earlier, had been reduced to scrap by a scream that had torn from Vader's scorched throat on his learning of his wife's death. Now, a 2-1B droid, responding to Vader's voiced instruction, was tending to an injury to Vader's left arm prosthesis, the cause of which he had yet to explain.
The last time you were in this facility, you were in no condition to supervise your own convalescence, Lord Vader,
Sidious said, his words transmitted to the pressurized laboratory by the antechamber's sensitive enunciators.
And I will remain ward of myself from this point forward,
Vader said through the intercom system.
Ward of yourself,
Sidious repeated in an exacting tone.
When it comes to overseeing modifications of this shell, Master,
Vader clarified.
Ah, as it should be.
The humaniform 2-1B was in the midst of executing Vader's instructions when sparks geysered from Vader's left forearm, and blue electricity began to gamble across his chest. With an infuriated growl, Vader lifted the injured arm, hurling the med droid halfway across the laboratory.
Useless machine!
He shouted.
Useless! Useless!
Sidious watched his apprentice with rising concern.
What is troubling you, my son? I'm aware of the suit's limitations, and of the exasperation you must be experiencing. But anger is wasted on the droid. You must reserve your rage for times when you can profit from it.
He appraised Vader again.
I think I begin to understand the cause of your frustration. Your rage owes little to the suit or the droid's ineptitude. Something disturbing occurred on Mercana. Some occurrence you have elected to keep from me. For your good or mine, I wonder.
Vader took a long moment to reply.
Master, I found the three Jedi who escaped Order 66.
What of it?
The damage to my arm was done by one of them, though she is now dead, by my blade.
And the other two?
They eluded me.
Vader lifted his scarred face to regard Sidious.
But they wouldn't have if this suit didn't restrict me to the point of immobility. If the Star Destroyer you placed at my command was properly equipped. If Sinar had completed work on the starfighter I designed.
Sidious waited until Vader was finished, then stood up and walked within a meter of the room's transparent panels.
So, my young apprentice, two Jedi slipped through your grasp, and you scatter the blame like leaves blown about by a storm.
Master, if you had been there...
Keep still, Sidious interrupted, before you damage yourself all the more.
He gave Vader a moment to compose himself.
First, let me reiterate that the Jedi mean nothing to us. In having survived, Yoda and Obi-Wan aren't exceptions to the rule. I'm certain that dozens of Jedi escaped with their lives, and in due time, you will have the pleasure of killing many of them. But of greater import is the fact that their order has been crushed. Finished, Lord Vader. Do I make myself clear?
Yes, Master,
Vader muttered.
In burying their heads in the sands and snows of remote worlds, the surviving Jedi humble themselves before the Sith. So let them atone for 1,000 years of arrogance and self-absorption.
The crew of the Drunk Dancer was every bit as surprised by their captain's revelations as Shrine was. For most of them, though, the disclosure only explained why they'd come to place so much trust in Jula's judgment and intuition. Shrine and the woman who claimed to be his mother were sitting in a dark alcove off the main cabin, untouched meals between them and blue-tinted holo images to one side, allegedly showing a 9-month-old Roan taking his first steps outside the modest dwelling that had been his home for just over 3 years. Clear across the cabin, Isle Dix, Philly Bitters, and Starstone were huddled around the ship's communication suite, into which Philly had managed to patch Bolshatak's beacon transceiver, and the Drunk Dancer was now transmitting on frequencies Jedi would scan in case of trouble or if attempting to establish contact with other Jedi. The talented young Slicer, whose face was nearly as colorless as his short spiked hair, was still trying his best to engage Starstone's interest. But she was either ignoring his attempts or simply too focused on awaiting a return signal to be aware of them. With her dark complexion and black curls and Bitter's toe-headed brilliance, they made for an interesting-looking couple. And Shrine wondered if perhaps Starstone hadn't unwittingly stumbled on a new path to follow. Elsewhere in the main cabin, Broody, Archer, and Skek were playing cards at a circular table. Labor droids whirring in to clean up their dropped snacks and spilled drinks. All in all, it was a pleasant setup, Shrine decided.
I never wanted you to be found, Jula said, when she had deactivated the holoprojector. To this day, I don't understand how your father could hand you over to the Jedi. When I learned he'd contacted the temple and that Jedi agents were coming for you, I tried to talk your father into hiding you.
That rarely happens, Shrine said. Most Force-sensitive infants were voluntarily surrendered to the temple.
Really? Well, it happened to me.
Shrine regarded her with his eyes and through the Force.
Who do you think you inherited your abilities from?
Jula asked.
Awareness does not always run in families.
He smiled lightly.
But I sensed the Force in you the moment you entered the cabin.
And I knew you did. Shrine exhaled and sat back in the chair.
So your own parents chose to keep you from joining the Order? She nodded. And I'm grateful they did. I would never have been able to abide by the rules, and I never wanted you to have to abide by them, Roan. She considered something. I have a confession to make. All my life, I've known that I would meet you somewhere along the way. I think that's partly the reason I took up piloting after your father and I separated, in the hope of, well, bumping into you. It's because of our force connection that I brought the Dancer to this sector. I sensed you, Roan. For many Jedi, luck and coincidence didn't exist, but Shrine wasn't one of them. What happened between you and your husband? He asked finally. Jula laughed shortly. You, really? Jen, your father, simply didn't agree with me about the need to protect you. To hide you, I mean. We argued bitterly about it, but he was a true believer. He felt that I should never have been hidden, that I'd basically turned my back on what would ultimately have been a more fulfilling life. And of course, that you would profit from being raised in the temple. Jen had the strength, I guess you could call it strength, to forget about you after he handed you over to the Jedi. No, that's too harsh. He had confidence enough in his decision to believe that he'd made the right choice and that you were doing well. Jula shook her head. I could never get there. I missed you. It broke my heart to see you leave and know that I might never see you again. That's what eventually ruined us. Shrine mulled it over. Jen sounds like he was a Jedi without the title. How so? Because he understood that you have to accept what destiny sets in front of you, that you have to pick and choose your battles. Her gray eyes searched his face. What does that make me, Roan? A victim of attachment. She smiled weakly. You know what? I can live with that. Shrine glanced away, catching Starstone's look before she quickly turned back to the communications console. She was eavesdropping on their conversation, worrying that the efforts she'd made to keep Shrine on the proper path were suddenly being undermined. Shrine could feel her wanting to tear herself away from the communications suite before it was too late, and Shrine was lost to the cause. He looked at Jula once more. I'll provide a confession in exchange for yours. I refused an assignment in the Temple's Acquisition Division. I'm still not sure why, except that I'd persuaded myself on some level that I didn't like the idea of kids being separated from their families. He paused briefly. But that was a long time ago. She took his meaning. Long ago in years, maybe. But I'm guessing you still feel like you missed out. On what? Life, Roan. Desire, romance, love, laughter, fun. All the things you've been denied. And children. How about that? A force-sensitive child you could nurture and learn from. He made his eyes dull. I'm not sure how force-sensitive a child of mine would be. Why is that? He gave his head a sharp shake. Nothing. From the comm suite came a cheer of excitement, and a moment later, Starstone was hurrying across the cabin toward them.
Roan, we got a hit! From a group of Jedi on the run!
She turned to Jula. Captain, with your permission, we'd like to arrange a rendezvous with their ship. Philly appeared at Starstone's side to elaborate.
We'd have to divert from our course to Mosak, but the rendezvous wouldn't take us too far out of the way.
Shrine felt Jula's eyes on him. I won't try to convince you, he said. It's your ship, and I'm sure you have important business elsewhere. Jula took a long moment to respond. I'll tell you why I'm going to do it. Just to have more time with you. With luck, enough time to persuade you to get to know us, and ultimately, to stay with us. She cut her eyes to Starstone. There's room for you too, Oli. Starstone blinked in indignation. Room for me? I'm not about to abandon my Jedi oath to go gallivanting around the galaxy with a band of smugglers, especially now that I know that other Jedi survived. She looked hard at Shrine. We have contact, Roan. You can't be taking her offer seriously. Shrine laughed out loud.
Normally, Padawans don't talk like this to Masters, he said to Jula. You can see how fast things have changed.
Starstone folded her arms across her chest.
You said I shouldn't call you master.
That doesn't mean you shouldn't respect your elders.
I do respect you, she said. It's your decisions I don't respect.
Many Jedi have left the temple to lead regular lives, Jula thought to point out. Some have gotten married and had children.
No, Starstone said, shaking her head back and forth. Maybe apprentices, but not Jedi Knights.
That can't be true, Jula said.
It is true, Starstone said firmly, before Shrine could say a word. Only 20 Jedi have ever left the Order.
Don't try to argue with her, Shrine advised Jula. She spent half her life in the temple library, polishing the busts of those lost 20.
Starstone shot him a gimlet look. Don't even think about being number 21.
Shrine let his sudden seriousness show. Despite your claims for me, I am not a master and there is no order. How many times are you going to have to hear it before you accept the truth?